Very much.
I'd like to begin today by thanking Hans and Gulchen for having me back to this most remarkable series of conferences in this very beautiful hotel here in beautiful Bodrum. And I hope that you're all having as good a time here as I am. Now, I've been asked to talk about financial markets in the ancient world. And I think it's rather pop out of it, and I wouldn't want you to be unduly excited. My answer is that there were financial markets in the ancient world. They were not as developed and as sophisticated as our own financial markets, but they were recognizably financial markets. That being said, I now want to turn to the nature and interpretation of the evidence of existence of financial markets. Now, if you want to talk about English and Dutch market civilization in the 17th and 18th centuries, there is a vast mass of information about those. If you want to talk about economic structures, there are newspapers, there are contemporary analyses, but there is no doubt that England and Holland in the 17th and 18th centuries were market societies. If you want to construct a sequential table of wheat prices and day labourers' wages in England, you can do that from 1250 onwards. There is the data. When we turn to the ancient world, when we turn to Greece and Rome, the information is for the most part not available. It's not available for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that the ancients did not share our interest in statistics, that they did not, at least they did not seem to have collected the kind of data that we take for granted. They also did not bother to keep it. We're not sure, for example, that the Roman government knew the actual population of Rome. It knew the number of taxpayers in Rome, it knew the number of tax-paying households in a particular city. But the idea of collecting statistics broken down by age and sex and class does not appear to have entered their minds. And certainly, they were far less interested than we are in things like money supply figures, births, deaths, and marriages, trade statistics, and all the other things that we have. We may be poor, they get, we may be poor, each to which they're put, but at least we do have these, and the ancients do not appear even to have tried to collect them. But there is then the problem that most of the literary evidence of the ancient world has just disappeared. Their civilization did collapse in the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, and a vast mass of literature, which had been preserved until then pretty well, just disappeared. If you look at the great historians of Rome, Livy and Tacitus, we have only large fragments of their works. And what we have has been mediated through various pockets of the Middle Ages who were not terribly interested in economic questions. Indeed, the ancient writers themselves were rather snobbish. They were just not interested in discussing the things which we often regard as all consuming interest. And so there is a shortage of hard evidence on which to base any conclusions. We then have the nature of how the evidence is interpreted. Now, you may assume, and I'll say more about this in a minute, you may assume that ancient societies were not societies, rather like ours. They were not so rich, they had the institution of slavery, and they were very high information and transport costs, broadly speaking, they were much the same as we are. However, within classical studies, during the past 50 years, an often dominant tradition has emerged in which it is simply denied that ancient societies were market societies. The two most important writers in the tradition are a Hungarian called Karl Polanyi, I believe is the pronunciation, though in the English speaking world we would simply call him Karl Polanyi, and the historian Moses Finch. Let me turn first to Polanyi, writing in the 1940s. He says, the concept of the market economy was born with the French physiocrats, simultaneously with the emergence of the institution of the market as a supply demand price mechanism. This was, in the course of time, followed by the revolutionary innovation of markets with fluctuating prices for the facts of production, labor, and land. He also says that prior to our own time, prior to the world of about 1800 onwards, no economy has ever existed that even in principle was controlled by markets. Gain and profit, made on exchange, never before the 19th century played an important part in human economy. Now that is a rather bold statement. As I said earlier, we may reject it flatly. In fact, I'm sure we do reject it flatly. But this has become dominant within large parts of classical studies and ancient studies. What Polanyi says is that instead of being based on a set of market transactions, the ancient economy was based on something else. And what was said is, the outstanding discovery of recent historical and anthropological research is that man's economy, as a rule, is submerged in his social relationships. He does not act so as to safeguard his individual interests in the possession of material goods. He acts as to safeguard his actual standing, his social claims, his social assets. He values material goods only insofar as they serve that end. In place of market behavior, Polanyi said that ancient or other pre-modern civilizations were based on the two principles of reciprocity and redistribution. Reciprocity means that you have a community in which one person specializes in making pots, another person specializes in making carpets, somebody else in hunting, somebody else in growing cabbages, and these people exchange products without prices and without any thought of making a profit, with no thought of it as a vulgar as material gain. What they are doing is producing because they feel it is their social duty to do so. And they exchange because that also is their social duty. Redistribution means that a harvest, or gains from foreign trade, or any other particular service is gathered in by a senator, it may be a state, it may be a priest, a priesthood, by aristocracy, and is then redistributed among the people on the basis of merit or need. And there may be prices in this kind of system, but they are prices which simply indicate equivalences of value so that goods can be distributed. For example, five cabbages may equal one chicken, which is quite useful to know if you're distributing these things, so that one person gets five cabbages and another person gets one chicken, and nobody feels left out. The idea that prices are formed by the twin forces of supply and demand, and if there's any change in supply and demand, prices change, that's an impossibility, that simply doesn't happen. Now, Polanyi did say that, yes, there was trade, in the ancient world, but trade usually took place at ports of trade, which were very carefully insulated from the territorial hinterland so that no information on prices could move from one to the other. And again, the prices at these ports of trade were mostly set by treaty between the various trading powers. Again, there was no thought that scarcity should enter into the price, or that the relative valuation of goods should enter into the formation of the price. And Pollard wrote mostly about the societies of the ancient Near East, Egypt, Sumeria, Babylonia, and so on. And summarizing research, he says, even in highly stratified archaic societies, such as Sumeria, Babylonia, Assyria, the Hittites, or Egypt, storage economies prevailed, and in spite of a large scale use of money as a standard, its use for indirect exchange was negligible. This may incidentally explain the complete absence of coins in the great civilizations of Babylonia and Egypt. Okay, so you have a flat denial of market activity in the civilizations of the past. Now, why should this be important? Because it's important to us wrong, but it's also important to us because it may be seen as part of the same corrosive attack on market civilization as we've seen from the Marxists and more particularly recent years from the post-Marxists. There are a number of ways in which you attack market civilization, and one of the big ways in which you can attack it is by saying that it is not a natural institution. We, as libertarians and conservatives, usually have at the back of our minds the notion that market behavior is part of human nature. So long as you do not have a grossly extended and grossly oppressive state, or an absolutely stultifying set of religious or cultural traditions, market behavior is what people do. Now, it doesn't mean that every time the government leaves people alone, we become Americans. As David Hume said a few hundred years ago, the Rhine flows to the north, the Rhone flows to the south. But water is water always runs down because of the force of gravity. Market behavior will be different in each society based on the intellectual and moral capacities of peoples, and also based on their prior cultural and religious tradition. But nevertheless, market activity is what people do naturally. That's what we believe. And it also seems to be what most other people believe. The idea that something is natural is an enormous argument to explain them in our society. If you argue, for example, that the family is a natural institution, that to a certain extent legitimizes the family. If you argue that slavery is an unnatural institution, that also to a certain extent delegitimizes slavery. It doesn't mean that slavery, once you argue that it's unnatural, is immediately abolished, because you can perhaps put arguments on the basis of its great utility or on the basis of its long cultural acceptance. But the moment you argue that something is natural, you raise a presumption in its favor, and when you argue that it's unnatural, you raise a presumption against it. And so part of our argument in favor of markets is that they are part of a natural order. And here you have a dominant tradition within classical scholarship saying that market behavior is not natural. Market behavior is something which has emerged in the past 200 years. It is a passing phase. Now, Pollard was a socialist, a relatively radical socialist, and he disliked market civilization. He regarded markets as immoral and unjust. And his wife says of him, "It is given to the best of our men somewhere to let down the roots of sacred hate in the course of their lives." This happened to Pollard in England. At later stages in the United States, it merely grew in intensity. His hatred was directed against market society and its effects, which divested men of his human shape. Speaking more bluntly, Pollard says, In order to comprehend German fascism, we must revert to Ricardian England. Now, again, you may say, well, it's the movement is still all about it. If you can argue that there was no market activity among the Aztecs, some aren't done, but they aren't done. After all, the Aztecs were people famous for ritual torture, mass human sacrifice, cannibalism. They had no writing, they did not have use of metals, they didn't seem to get anything from people. You can hardly actually say that this was a civilization. And the other civilizations, or the other cultures in South America, were mainly a better. The Spanish conquest was, in own terms, a remarkable operation, but you might argue that in the long term, the Spanish did a considerable benefit to the people of South America by conquering them and converting them to Christianity. But when you say this of the ancient civilization of the Iberians, it's no matter. And when you say it of the Greeks and Romans, it is certainly another matter. Because the Greeks and Romans are at the heart of our civilization. They are the foundations on which we build. We may be Turkish Muslims, we may be German barbarians from the north, we may be Italians and Spanish and Greeks and French. Our ancestors may have helped destroy the civilization. They have helped preserve it. But in all senses, the Greeks and the Romans are the foundation of our civilization where we stand now. And if you can argue that the Greeks and Romans did not know market behavior in the sense that we do, then it does, in a certain sense, undercut our claim that market behavior is natural. It's natural. It's part of human nature. And so this is a debate that's been going on for 50 years. The Polanyi and Moses Dibi tradition, as I said, a third time, is dominant in certain areas. And so it is of some importance to us as conservative and libertarian activists and scholars to be aware of this debate and to know exactly how we should move it. Now you cannot simply say, oh, market behavior is theologically part of human nature, therefore Polanyi and Dibi are wrong. Their answer to this is to say, you know, this is economic stoicism, or the Marxists call it false consciousness, or gradually called a discourse. You have been so conditioned by your circumstances that you are unable to conceive of anything other than the world in which you live. And so your argument that market behavior is part of human nature, therefore there was market behavior, may not be perfectly valid, but it will be rejected by these people. So what you could do is you could look at the definitions of market economy given by Polanyi and Finley. And there are something better grounds, because these people seem to assume that unless you have a dog-eat-dog cutthroat kind of economy, or at least the kind of economy that you see described in Paul Samuelson's famous textbook, it's not a market economy. If you can show any degree of reciprocity and redistribution, therefore it's not a market economy, therefore Polanyi and to a certain extent Finley must be right. And of course, that's a ridiculous definition. Modern England and modern America are undeniably market economies, but something like half to three quarters of the transactions in those countries take place outside the market. My wife ironed this jacket for me earlier. She did not have to be paid for it. I change my water soap panties. I don't keep a tab on it. Friends who favors the people, relatives who favors the people, we give to charity. Large organizations, large companies, quite often transactions are allowed to take place at zero price or at prices set for the person who diminishes convenience. You will, in a modern economy, see an enormous amount of reciprocity and, in that sense, a great deal of redistribution. And so, Polanyi and Finley are wrong, simply because of their definition of a market economy. If you try to apply their categories to modern England and modern America, you could say that they are within sight, so the Sumerians and the ancient Egyptians, which would be a plain absurdity. But these are also being questions of evidence. And as I said, the problem with evidence in ancient societies is that most of it has disappeared. It's rather, imagine for a second, a very beautiful mosaic which has been broken up and most of the tiles thrown away. You have a few pictures here and there, a great mass of tiles, and you must somehow reconstruct the whole from the fragments of the parts that are there. It is difficult to do, but it can be done with some certainty. And in my view, the most exciting work on ancient polymers has not been done by a classicist, but by an economist called Maurice Silver, who does not appear to know any of the specific languages, but does show some familiarity with Greek and Latin. Maurice Silver published his first article on the subject in German Economic History in 1983. And when I read this a little while ago, I want to shout with laughter. It is a 37-page point-by-point demolition of Ptolemy. It takes every piece of evidence adduced by these people against indices and markets and shows that it is in fact evidence for markets. Let me read you the abstract to this article. This essay challenges Karl Ptolemy's position that ancient Near Eastern economies use state and temple administration, but not price-making markets. It is found that the prerequisite functions of a market economy, this is by Ptolemy, the allocation of consumer goods, land, and labor through the supply demand price mechanism, risk bearing organized as a market function, and loan markets, were all present in the ancient Near East. Although Ptolemy criticized state theories for their privileges of continuity, he imposed his own notion of continuity of history in lumping together many thousands of years under the rubric of archaic society. This perspective prevented him from recognizing that ancient Mesopotamia experienced lengthy and significant periods of unfettered market activity, as well as periods of pervasive state regulation. I recommend you go and find the article and to read the service. He also expanded it into a book published in 1995, which is also well worth getting out and reading. And so, Maurice Silver shows that there was market activity in the ancient Near East. So let's see what evidence there might be for market activity in Greek and Roman civilization. Now, I don't want to ask about the lot of things, so I'll give you one example. From Aristotle Politics, Book 1, Section 9. It's an anecdote of Thales of Miletus, who lived just down the road from us. According to the story, like his skills in the stars while it was in winter, that there would be a great harvest of olive oil in the coming year. So having a little money, he gave deposits for the use of all the olive presses in Chios and Miletos, which he hired at a low price because no one would pay it to. When the harvest time came, and many were full of plants and of sun, he let them out at any rate they pleased and made all the money. Now, Finley would say, oh, that's an example of predatory capitalism, it's not actual market access, you know, this is peripheral stuff. But hang on, look at it. What you have here is an example for a contract. And it may not be a true story, but there's Aristotle writing in Athens, and Aristotle and his readers appear to be familiar with the idea of putting down deposits for the future use of economic resources. Indeed, Aristotle says that nobody else did against Athens, and so Thales did not think of four markets and go around and making profit from them. He took advantage of a pre-existing market structure. It seems to be quite normal for the use of oil presses to be rented out months, or perhaps even a year in advance. There was auction. Nobody else did against him. He made these contracts, which meant that there was a legal system which was accustomed to dealing with contracts, and making contracts in the expectation that they would be influenced by politics. And he made those contracts with people who appeared to have kept them. Fowey's put down his pockets, didn't put full money down. It was an option. He made these contracts, and then a mild time came around. You didn't have the enraged community taking this oil presses from him and using them for their reciprocal or redistributed economic activity. No. They went to Fowey and said, please, can we use the live press? And we had it for 20 little balls of meat or something. And he made money from this. But now, as I said, the evidence for ancient economic activity is all of its nature. It's anecdotal stories, which may be true, may be false. But even a false story, it is useful. It's useful to show the assumptions of the people among the story first circle. You want a few pieces of Tacitus about a major financial crisis in Rome in 33 AD, which does show that there was a strong linkage of capital and land markets. Interest rates only shot up, the price of land collapsed. And this crisis was only lifted when the emperor lent 100 million sesterces interest rate for 3 years. And that the Austrians are using the same method to always deal with the financial crisis. But you know, even a wrong economic theory gives some indication that people were willing to think about economics and that they want an economy to think about. So, in conclusion, I would say there do appear to have been financial markets in the ancient world, but much more important than that. There were market economies. The Greeks and Romans were the richest we are. They didn't know many things we do. They had a grossly imperfect numbering system. Information costs were staggeringly high, and transport costs often made trade prohibitive beyond 3 miles inland from their trade. But there could be no reasonable doubt that these were market economies in the sense that we would recognize, and in the sense that people analyze using the standard mechanisms of microeconomic theory. And I would again suggest that this is not an obscure debate among academics in a subject of which you may have little knowledge and in which you have little interest. This is a very important debate because if the Polari and Finn thesis about ancient economies continues to dominate classical studies, there is one more large island or the continent of socialism in the universities. Very few people may read this stuff, but generation after generation of students are exposed to it. And millions of people are exposed to it indirectly through films, television documentaries, newspaper articles, and so on. And because of the enormous prestige of the Greeks and Romans, any evidence regarding their behavior does have some persuasive value among us. So if you are interested in following this debate further, a good place to start is that article on my website, which, as I said, contains all citations and a great deal more information I've given you to start with. And that being said, I've had my 30 minutes. I'd like to thank you for your great indulgence and thank you, Hans and Gordon.